This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The following program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is prepared in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Welcome to this corner of the bookshelf. Our presentation is from a book written by one of the TRRS volunteers, Myra Yarborough de Brule. It is entitled Changing Places, and it recounts her years and experiences of growing up while attending the then North Carolina State School for the Blind, now known as the Governor Morehead School, here in Raleigh. Mr. Brule has written this book and is also reading it for this presentation from a Braille transcript prepared by the Department of the Services for the Blind, which is located on the grounds of the Governor Morehead School. She has also composed the music that is being used in this presentation. And now, Myra Yarborough de Brule, with a dedication, introduction, and reading of her book, Changing Places, Things I Learned at the North Carolina State School for the Blind in the 1950s.
To every one of my friends who walked these years with me, to my parents who lived alongside me in their hearts, to my children who have heard these stories a million times, to my grandchildren who have brought such joy into my life. Preface. This is a book about countless, very real, yet somewhat fictionalized situations lived out in the years between 1950 and 1963 at the State School for the Blind in Raleigh, North Carolina. Even though the story takes my life and follows it all the way through those years, it is mostly the actual campus and the school that lends itself to the time and events that shaped many lives, ways of living, teaching, learning, thinking, and relating have changed immensely from the time the story begins until it ends 13 years later. Students came from as far away as Manio or Murphy, North Carolina, and met in the state's capital of Raleigh, where they were expected to embrace new things, sometimes making it very difficult for little children to understand where home really was. We lived in the times when rock and roll music was introduced, when stereos were not commonplace, where TVs, if anyone had one, were black and white, when schools were not air-conditioned, where computers lived in science fiction movies, cell phones were not even thought of, and integration was just an idea. We perceived ourselves through the lens of blindness in this out-of-the-way shelter as well as in the city churches and in our own hometowns. Methods of teaching blind students have changed through the years, but this book is only concerned with how we lived with blindness in our daily lives during this particular time period. The changes over the course of these years will take you through the mountains and valleys in North Carolina, which are told as reflective memories. These stories live in diaries and the minds of friends, as told by my parents and teachers, and some simply from my own perceptions. This book is filled with my truth and my own sense of things growing up. This book is an opportunity and a privilege for me to preserve a unique life experience, all while allowing you to come along and learn, live, and grow alongside the reality of my own self and my classmates. I am still learning how to understand life and blindness from many points of view. This book plays these viewpoints out in a storybook fashion. Although I've played with the exact timing and fictionalized some dialogue, the events are real. Enjoy and travel to a time that's both near and far away. I should mention that today, in 2014, the school I attended in 1950 is now named the Governor Morehead School. Even though the campus is at the same location, some of the circumstances that occurred during my years would never occur there today. Children go home most every weekend, have house parents who are taught how to understand and help students adjust, and teachers must learn how to teach special needs children, as most of the students who now attend do have other needs besides blindness. When I was a student in the 1950s, life on the campus was in a boarding school fashion, not seeing our parents for 6 weeks at a time. Some students only went home twice in 1 year. This type of existence is a strong focus of my story. In later years, I talked extensively with Mother, Geneva, about how it was for her when I left home for school. As I now have children of my own, I wanted to understand what it was like for a mother to leave her child and drive over 100 miles away. Geneva's story is the only portion of this book written in the third person and comes from her answers during our long talks later in life. While my parents' lives went on in Lexington as mine did in Raleigh, I seemed to disconnect in a way that prevented me from understanding Geneva's point of view through those remaining school years. Prologue, Geneva's Story, Lexington, North Carolina, 1950. Many nights, Geneva lay awake until almost midnight. This particular night, she was still busy in her mind, even though she knew how important it was for her to get a good night's sleep. It had been almost 6 weeks since she slept well. That is how long ago it was when she and Lee left their little girl, Susie, at the State School for the Blind in Raleigh, North Carolina. Susie was already talking to one of the little girls when they had left her. Mrs. Johnson, the house mother, had assured them that she would be just fine before they said goodbye. Lee had bounced Susie's curls with his hand, and Geneva had handed her the brand new doll she had just bought the day before. The house seemed so quiet when they returned home, quiet for nights and days to come, except for the sounds a family makes in their usual daily activities, and for that of Larry crying at night, wondering where his sister was. It seemed to Geneva that Lee never talked about Susie except to brag about the steam heat and the indoor plumbing in the big brick dormitory where she was now living. Lee said it was a fine school, and Susie would come out smarter than all of them. Geneva was expected not to cry about her child. She tried desperately to think of it as a blessing, an opportunity for Susie to have a better education and a better life. It hadn't seemed like a blessing to Geneva, all those nights without her little girl to kiss goodnight. She never kissed Susie goodnight, though. Maybe it was just knowing that now she couldn't that made her want to. Geneva wanted to tonight. Geneva had wondered 1,000 times if Susie was afraid. Was she warm? Was the doll able to be the love she needed? She was such a little girl, but she could already count to 100 and spell every word in her brother Larry's second-grade reader. Would anybody notice? Geneva wondered. Geneva wanted to be the one to pick out the dress for Susie's first day of school and to hear about it when it was over. Did she talk about home? Did she talk about Larry? She even wondered if her house mother had remembered to call her Susie. Her real name was Myra, but in Lexington she had always been known as Susie. Geneva was sure they had remembered, hadn't they? Susie could only see in contrast. In order to communicate his life with her, Larry had carefully drawn large white letters on a black chalkboard until Susie knew them all. He could entertain her for hours by drawing words, letters, and numbers on the board. Susie would come away with a white chalk nose. Larry would call her Eskimo Face. She would jump on him and give him an Eskimo kiss. Eventually, the children would have to be separated before a real fight started. Many nights now, Geneva slipped quietly out of bed and went to the kitchen table, where memories turned over and over like pages in a book. How many nights had she sat there with her hands folded in her lap to keep them from shaking? One night she had pulled the chain in the electric bulb Lee's mother lived across the street behind several trees, but the next day she had come over to see why a light was on in the middle of the night. Geneva guessed the light must look like a moon in the country darkness. Now she took down the little kerosene lantern that hung by the kitchen door and lit it as the October coolness settled over her. The tablecloth came alive with its plastic rosebuds that suddenly seemed to bloom. The salt and pepper shakers stood at attention at the end of the table. The white curtains at the window hung limp. Just a few weeks ago, they had waved when she had sat there whispering a peaceful sigh to her mind. Now Geneva got up to get the quilt from Susie's bed. As she did this, she noticed how the lantern in her hand cast a shadowy silhouette of a little doll she saw dressed up in one of Susie's old snowsuits. Every time it happened, for a second, she was surprised at the illusion the doll's blonde braids created. Then she remembered, tomorrow night, Susie really would be sleeping here. Suddenly comforted, she turned down the lantern wick and lay down on the little bed, pulling Susie's quilt snugly about her. Part 1, Chapter 1, My Story. It was a little rented country house where we lived, Mama, Daddy, my brother Larry, and I. It wasn't a grand TV show of a house like the Little House on the Prairie, or a family like the TV Waltons, but it was home. I still remember the wooden family high chair my papaw made, where I sat every evening to eat supper until I was age 7 and was finally big enough at 30 pounds to sit at the kitchen table. Sometimes now I see the little house in my head, the front porch full of family all listening to Lucille Ball on the radio, the neighbor boy coming down to shoot marbles in the dirt, or Larry and I rolling down the red clay hill beside the house. I also remember playing a game called roller bat. It was exactly like softball, except someone rolled the ball and hit the bat, and if they did, the batter went to the bases. Mama and Papa lived across the narrow two-lane country road with their own swing on the front porch and family filling it up every Sunday afternoon. Larry and I played there as well, cowboys and Indians in the wooded area behind the cow pasture, or we sat on the limbs of the large umbrella tree out back. We would shell beans in the summertime and could hear rain coming through the woods long before it ever got to the gardens. Mama read to us every night. I remember a book called The Eskimo Twins, and Larry and I rubbed our noses together like the Eskimos and giggled like the 4 and 5 year olds we were. Long summer days and winter nights crossed my mind like a ride on Daddy's slow tractor through the fields or Mama's Saturday mornings at the 5 and dime. My other grandparents, Mama's parents, lived up in Lexington, where they had water that ran without a well and a bathroom just outside the kitchen door. I feel Granny Kimbrell's hands, which were used to working in a mill, holding my own tiny hands and telling me to keep them so soft and smooth like a baby's hands. And Papaw Kimbrell loved to dance. He could tap dance and entertain us grandchildren for a long time with the sound his shoes made hitting the wooden floor, and he carried maple nut candy in his pockets for us all. No matter where I went with my family, I experienced love. We didn't talk about love at all in the little wooden house, but it was a palpable thing to my heart, my emotions, and my life. I touched it from my daddy's shoulders, riding as high as the sky, holding Larry's hands as we ran to the newest hideout we made together, smelling Mama's bread baking in the oven, and tasting the homemade ice cream we made on hot Sunday afternoons. I heard it in my heart as Mama sang along with the radio, and I saw love like the sun peeping through the tree branches as the sun and the wind played together, making shadows. Little did I know of anything else, just my little safe house where I could be a little girl, a little blind girl, and didn't seem to realize that anything would ever change. I remember a poem. I remember when linoleum was so new, it was just a linoleum rug laid on the unfinished wooden floor, and we loved it. Earmuffs, for when it was cold or your ears hurt, which never worked for either. The smell of gum in Mama's purse. Riding on Daddy's shoulders. The way my brother Larry's neck felt when he just got a haircut. The way my heart felt when he would play with me. Baby bottles that were really glass and had homemade canned milk formula inside. Easter egg nests made in the grass that the Grandma Easter Bunny always found. Really picking out the Christmas tree and dragging it home. Exactly the way a chicken's legs feel when it's alive. The clothes being frozen on the line. The way my tongue felt after sticking it into the electric fan. Cars as slow as snails and puppy dog tails. Thinking mud puddles were heaven. Winter coats that weighed as much as I did. Thinking since a nickel was heavier, it was worth more than a dime. The way only Mama's cake batter tasted when getting to lick the bowl. Playing snake in the gully with a real gully and sometimes a real snake. Hearing the little children at church whispering, "She's blind." I remember going away to school. Chapter 2, Raleigh, North Carolina. "Want a drink?" someone said to me. In the fall of 1950, I stood on a cement porch that seemed as long as a city block. My one eye that could see some light searched everywhere for the sun. In Lexington, the sun set just over the umbrella tree in Mama's backyard, but now it seemed to have moved too, like I did. I clutched the doll Mama had handed me just before she and Daddy disappeared. I could see that her dress was pink, but that is all I could see. I rubbed my eye as if it would make the sun shine, but nothing happened. My hand came away wet, and I realized that I was crying. Everybody was crying. Mama had told me stories about how I would go to school a long way from home in a big building, and I would have lots of little girls to play with. I held the doll up to my shoulder, causing her to cry too. I took a few tentative steps, hoping that I would not fall off this big porch, but maybe if I got far enough away, I would be able to see my son. "Want a drink?" the voice repeated before I could move too far. "So, they have cooks here," I thought. "Maybe it won't be such a bad place after all." In Lexington, they had a Coca-Cola plant, and Larry would always look to see where my bottle came from. "Maybe Lexington is not so far away," I thought. The hand that held mine was cool and dry. My little slippery hand held on tight. We went through the heavy doors of the building. To me, it felt very big inside, like a church, but even bigger. The hallway was very dark, and boards creaked under our little white patent leather Sunday shoes. The hall was shaped sort of like a cross, with a straight part leading to the dining room past the clothes closet. Branches met in the middle, with left going to our own beds and right going to several rooms for the older girls, but I didn't know that just then. I didn't even know that all the little girls who were crying were blind, too, like me, wondering what had just happened. All I knew just then was that my mind seemed to fill up this empty hall with questions. "Do you like it here?" I asked. "I'm in the second grade, and my name's Hannah," the girl answered. "I know everybody here. Last year, we had a mean old house mother. We called her a witch." The hall seemed to keep on going. I couldn't see light coming into it from anywhere. It made me feel like I was in a tunnel. Larry and I liked tunnels. We would scream, and I would put both my hands over his eyes so he couldn't see the light at the end. Smells of pimento cheese, new luggage, and mothballs came from pathways in front of us and met somewhere in the center of the dormitory. Hannah held my doll as she put my hand on something cool. It was a grooved knob. "Turn it," she said as she pushed my head down. My chin landed on something hard. I reached out in front of me with my other hand to examine the object. It was a big square bowl. I reached my arm around it as far as I could. Then I reached my hand down under my chin to examine the splatter. I stuck my tongue into the stream of wetness and found it was only water. In Lexington, to have a drink meant a Coke. This stuff didn't even taste like water. What kind of a place could it be where drinks come from a bowl with a knob instead of a well with a dipper? I hate this place, I thought, as Lexington seemed to gurgle down the drain of the fountain alongside the water. Hannah led me back outside and showed me a big rocking chair. "Give me my doll," I said. "I want to play with her," she answered. "Give her to me," I cried, desperate to hold on to the one familiar thing in my life. I heard my doll hit the cement porch and jumped out of the chair to feel for the sound that she made as she landed. I held her close as I sat back down in the rocker, hiding my face in her cloth stomach. My chin touched something hard, and I guess this must be the thing that made her cry when I turned her over. I began singing to the doll. "Rock-a-bye, baby, in the treetop." I was surprised when I heard another little girl join in the singing. "Jesus loves me, this I know," I sang, as more little girls joined in. "Well, now, you are just going to keep everybody from getting homesick," a big voice said. The big voice was about to find out she was wrong. We were all led into the dining room inside the big building for a supper of sandwiches. "You can't bring that doll to the table," the voice said as she took her from my arms. "Give her back," I screamed. "I want my doll. I want my mama. I want my daddy. Give her back. Give me my doll." Once more, my new doll hit the floor as the chair was pulled out from the table and I was pushed down hard onto the wooden seat. "Stop it," growled the big voice as her hands shook my shoulders. "You will not sass me. You will stop that crying or you won't get anything to eat." "I don't want to eat. I want my mama." "Belvia, come and get Myra and take her to her bed," the big voice said. Suddenly, a girl came and put her hands on my chair. First, she bent down to find the doll, and then she took my hand and stood me up. Her hand felt the top of my head. "My goodness," she said, "you are just a tiny little thing, aren't you?" She handed me the doll and picked me up in her arms, carrying me on her hip out of the dining room. I put my empty arm around her neck and buried my head in her dress as I sobbed. She carried me down the long tunnel hall into a large room and set me on a bed. She showed me a chair that sat at the head of my bed. Then she showed me where my drawers were and the little dresser at the other end. For a few minutes, she picked me up again and cradled me in her arms as she sat on the bed and rocked me like I had rocked my doll just before supper. "That's a mean old woman," I said. "That's Mrs. Johnson," Belvia said. "She's our house mother. Try to do what she says, and that will keep you from getting in trouble." "I want my mama," I started to cry again. "I know you do," Belvia said. "Oh, honey, I know you do. But try as hard as you can not to cry, because it makes Mrs. Johnson mad. Come on now, and let me help you find your pajamas and get you ready for bed. First, I'll show you where the bathroom is." After learning about a bathroom that had little seats to sit on behind the door that locked like my screen door in Lexington, Belvia showed me the sinks, soap, and paper towels. It felt like a bathroom at a gas station we had stopped at once going to the beach, but it didn't smell so bad. Belvia picked me up again and carried me to my bed and taught me how to pull down the spread, and what Belvia told me was a top sheet. I climbed in. I was surprised to find myself between two stiff, slippery things. At home, Larry slept with me to keep me from being afraid. We slept on a big bed under lots of blankets to keep us warm. Belvia handed me the doll and kissed me goodnight. The tears started again, but I turned my head into the pillow trying to be quiet. Soon other girls were being brought to their beds, and the room became dark. I cowered between the little cold, slippery things Belvia had told me were sheets. Mama, Daddy, and Larry were gone. I wondered if Larry was missing me, but he probably was in bed, too, under the warm blankets. He wasn't afraid of the dark like I was. It felt so cold in that little dark bed. It was hard not to cry out loud. So I slipped down into the middle of the slippery coolness and turned my head as far as I could into the sheets. I thought about the Lone Ranger and began building a daydream. The Lone Ranger would rescue me. It was days later when I found out that Belvia was blind like me, that most of the girls were blind like me, and that we all wanted just to sit and cry for our mamas and daddies for days. This had been my first lesson in being homesick. Over the next 6 weeks, I was sure I had learned everything there was to know about it. Yet almost every night, I picked up the hard-headed doll and cried it to sleep. I had long since stripped the doll of her little pink silk dress and bonnet so I could call her Larry. This night I spanked the doll's cloth bottom for crying when I turned it over. "They won't let you go home if you don't be good," I said to the doll. 16 little beds stood in double rows in the big ward of K Cottage. At the other end of the long hall, there were rooms for 12 more little girls in the second and third grades. Tomorrow, 28 girls would see their families after almost 6 weeks. Earlier that night, I had got a spanking from Mrs. Johnson, but it didn't hurt. Nothing could hurt me on the night before I was going home. I imagined how it would be. Mama and Daddy would get into the car. Daddy would turn the key, hoping the car would start. Once it did, and he got onto the open road, he would say, "Want to see how fast you'll go?" Mama would always answer, "No, you will scare Susie to death." Chapter 3, Transition. Lee started the engine of his brand new 1951 red Chevrolet and turned onto Highway 64 toward Raleigh. "Want to see how fast you'll go?" he asked Mama. "No." "Oh, I thought you was in a hurry." "I am, but I want to be alive when I get there," Geneva answered. "Do you think she'll have changed much?" "In 6 weeks." Geneva settled back onto the new vinyl cushions. She rolled up the window on her side so as not to completely rearrange the curls she had worked so hard to arrange just right for meeting my house mother and the other mothers that she was going to see. Tall pine and cedar trees lined the road for miles as the sun flashed its afternoon light through their branches. The road was narrow and straight. I'm sure Geneva thought the straightness of the road should make her feel closer to me, but the miles went on and on. She closed her eyes and pictured her little girl riding on the seat between her and Lee. She would French plait Susie's hair on the way home. She had remembered to bring some hair ribbons and a brush. Somehow, the sleep she missed the night before cradled her mind in peace. It seemed like a short time until her head jerked. Geneva found that Lee had parked the car at a small store near the school. "I can make it the rest of the way. Why are we stopping here?" "I'm going to get a Coke," Lee told her as he took the little black comb from his shirt pocket and tried to make sense of his wind-blown thick black hair. Geneva looked around at the store that looked to her like a big square white box. She saw people walking around the corner of the store and wondered what was back there. A few children seemed to be excited about something. They had driven almost 100 miles. Geneva guessed Lee must need to stop to stretch his legs, but couldn't he have waited another few miles? As he got back into the car, he handed Geneva a Coke, took one for himself, and set the third one, unopened, on the seat between them. Then Geneva knew. He had stopped to get a Coke for me, just like he had bought the red car because he thought I might be able to see it. He knew I probably could see the red car. "What was going on at the back of that store?" Geneva asked. "The man has monkeys back there," he told her. "They call it the monkey store, and he said lots of students from the blind schools stop there on their way home. I bet Susie would get a kick out of those monkeys." The Chevy hummed along the last 10 miles of the trip and came to a stop beside a big red building. At the side of the road, there was a stone path leading up to the sidewalk. Geneva almost jumped out of the car. She forgot she was wearing high heels and stumbled up the stones on shaky knees. The sidewalk forked into 3 walks, each leading to the porch and some steps which led inside. Geneva and Lee started up the middle set of steps. They passed little girls and parents with suitcases. Geneva smiled and nodded. Then Geneva heard a familiar sound, her little girl singing. She looked toward my voice. Her eyes fell on a little blonde head that was moving back and forth in a big green cane-bottom rocker. There were no curls and no braids in the hair. There was almost no hair. Geneva's mouth dropped open, but her voice was nowhere to be found. "Hey, punk," Lee said. "Susie?" Mama squeaked from somewhere in her throat. I jumped out of the chair and threw my arms out toward the sound of the voices. I found my mama's waist and held on to it, lifting my feet the way I always did when I was playing around. Mama's hand rested on my head. My feet landed on the cement. I put my hands on the top of my head and felt the stubble, the little twigs that were no longer curls. "Do you like it?" I asked. "Susie, did you cut your hair?" Mama asked.
"No, Mrs. Johnson did."
"Why did she do that?"
"Do you like it, Daddy?"
I did a few little half-skip steps toward Daddy.
"Did you bring me something?"
"How about a drink?"
"Where's Larry?"
"Larry had school today," Mama said.
"You mean he didn't come?"
"He's waiting for you at home," Daddy reassured me. "Come on, I've got something to show you."
"I'm going to talk to Mrs. Johnson," Mama said as she walked through the big double doors that led into the long hall.
"I'm going with Daddy," I said as he knelt down for me to climb on his shoulders. I was at home up here, with the familiar smell of tobacco, hair tonic, and chewing gum. After walking through the doors, Geneva passed the teacher's parlor on the right. She quickly noted the gray carpet, gray couch with tiny white flowers, 2 matching chairs, a small table with a radio in the corner beside a lamp with a shade that looked like an upside-down umbrella. The children's kindergarten room was to the left. She stopped just a moment to look at the tiny cane-bottom chairs that sat around the walls and at the little wooden desk and at the piano with colorful wooden toys in boxes on both sides of it. I'm sure she must have wondered which chair I sat in, but she quickened her steps as she heard the deep-throated voice she knew belonged to Mrs. Johnson. Geneva found her down the hall in a big room filled with little lockers, clothes, suitcases, and a table with a big book of names. Mrs. Johnson looked up from the book.
"Oh, Mrs. Yarborough, isn't it? Myra's mother."
Geneva heard the name, but for a moment it seemed like this woman must be talking about someone else. For a second she was distracted and lost her resolve as she wondered why her daughter was not being called Susie, which is what she had put on the school forms as her nickname.
As the moment seemed to take her mind away, she absently shook her head. "Can you imagine what it's like trying to remember mothers for 28 little girls? Now I have to check them all out for the weekend. This first time for me, it's a job. Myra sure isn't any trouble. She's a good little girl." "Is that why you cut her hair?" Mrs. Johnson laid down her pen. "No, I cut her hair because I also have 28 heads to comb every morning. Myra cried because she said rats slept in her curls. I certainly don't have time to deal with rats' nests on top of everything else." Geneva felt her courage waver beneath her rage. The heavy-set house mother looked at her with eyes that seemed to know every possible question she wanted to ask, though Geneva couldn't even think of all the questions she had planned. There seemed to be no expression on this ordinary face or in the brown eyes with thick lashes looking back at her. The hair was short and curly, and the dress was as brown as her eyes. The only distinguishing feature was the volume of the deep, commanding voice. Geneva felt like if Mrs. Johnson told the building to collapse, it would obey. "Myra's one of the best girls I've got," she went on. "You can tell that she has been taught well at home." Geneva finally recovered enough to ask, "Does she cry a lot?" "Probably not as much as you do." Two more mothers were entering the room with the same expressions on their faces Geneva had worn as she entered. Geneva glanced at the suitcases that were lined up in a row next to the door. She looked back into Mrs. Johnson's gaze and wondered if she ever blinked. Geneva continued the conversation in mechanical style, and Mrs. Johnson responded with answers that all seemed to have been rehearsed. Myra Yarbrough was written on the list of names to be away for the weekend. Geneva smiled at the other mothers as she picked up my suitcase and headed outside. As soon as Daddy saw her, she spoke to Daddy like I wasn't even there. "6 weeks ago, we left little Susie with long braids. Now we've come to pick up little Myra with no hair." She seemed frustrated, and when she finally reached the car, she found me sitting up on the hood playing with the radio aerial. "You're going to let her get greasy," she said to Lee. "We're going to see if we can pick up Lexington from here." "Oh, Lee, you know you can't. Come on, let's go." "Tell Mama how you like the car, Punk," Daddy coaxed as he lifted me from the hood. I scrambled like a squirrel to his chest, hung on tight around his neck until he promised to ride me on his shoulders at least halfway down the long sidewalk in front of Kay Cottage. Daddy told me that if Mama knew how to drive, we would be at least 10 miles down the road in Cary by now. After a few minutes, Daddy brought me back to the car, and I hurried up onto the seat between him and Mama. Daddy took what he called a church key from the glove compartment and opened the drink. Then he handed it to me. "Oh, a drink!" I squealed. It seemed like forever since I had had a Coke. I examined the bottle carefully, feeling the 7 glass ridges that ran vertically until they reached the part where the lettering began. I held it up in front of my eyes until I could see the dark liquid against the light green shadow of the colored glass. "Is it all mine?" "You always know just what to do for her," Mama said. I took several swallows before Mama reached over and pulled my hands down. Finally, we were on the way. "Why don't you like the car, Mama?" I asked. "I do like it," Mama said. "Daddy said you call it an apple." "Well, I like apples, too." "Will this car get us home fast?" I asked. "Mama doesn't want to go fast," Daddy said.
"I do. Make it go fast, Daddy."
Chapter 4. Home. Larry was staying at Mamaw's while Mama and Daddy had been to Raleigh. He grabbed me by the throat, and my knee found its familiar place in the middle of his stomach. For a few seconds, we wrestled like we were mad at each other, then jumped up and laughed. Larry grabbed my hand, and we ran outdoors toward the woods to find the brand new hideout he had made just for this day. We ran past the big umbrella tree I loved in Mama's backyard, past the green hedge that served almost like a fence around the house, past the smokehouse and the shed. We wriggled underneath the sharp wire fencing and on toward the branch, coming to a small hill. We always pretended it was a mountain. To anyone else, it was just a big hole in the side of a hill with October leaves for a floor and an old window shade for a door. To us, it was the strongest fort in the South. Larry closed the door and the fort became completely dark. "Now, I'm like you," Larry said, "and I got you something." I reached out to take a little metal cap gun from Larry. "This one shoots just one cap at a time, and you can do it yourself," he said. "I know you can do it, because I loaded it here in the dark myself yesterday." He handed me the roll of caps and peered around the edge of the shade to load his own automatic. "Gotcha," I said, happy that I really could load my gun without his help. "No, you didn't." Larry leaped out of the hideout with me at his heels, and the game was on. I couldn't shoot my gun fast enough to keep up with the times that I got shot. Somewhere in my six-year-old mind, I understood that Larry must be running in circles. For a little while, the woods were filled with the familiar cowboy and Indian war sounds. The cows seemed to know to step aside. I stopped occasionally to touch a familiar tree along the dirt path that led down toward the branch. I knew if Larry got to the string before I did, he would be safe, so I increased my speed. My spirit seemed to be running ahead of me, and I tried to catch up. "I'm going to shoot you dead a million times," I shouted. Then, crash! I fell hard onto a big rock that hadn't been there before. "You're dead," Larry shouted. "That ain't fair, Larry. You put this big rock in my way." "No, I didn't." Papaw decided to put some rocks leading down to the water so we wouldn't get so muddy walking down here. "I forgot about it. Okay, you're not dead. You're not even hurt. Come on, let's play." I hated the rock. Last summer, Papaw had decided to make a wooden bridge across the big gully. I didn't like the plank either. I liked sliding down the little, nasty, swampy gully and coming up on the other side, red mud and all. But I really hated the rock without knowing why, except they were there. That evening, Larry, Mama, Daddy, and I sat together at the supper table at our house. I tasted my meat and said, "Fat back." "Oh, you know that's white ham," Daddy said. "Don't they have fancy things like that in Raleigh?" "No," I said. "I don't know what they have, but it ain't good." "Mrs. Johnson said you eat real good," Mama said. "I have to eat what's on my plate or I'll get a spanking," I said. "I bet your butt stays sore all the time then," Larry said. "It don't neither." I reached over to slap his arm and knocked his milk over. Larry and Mama jumped up to get a rag. "See what you did?" Larry said. "No," I said. "If I could see, I wouldn't be at a blind school." I had heard Hannah say that one time. "That was the last glass, too," Larry said, trying to turn sympathy in his way. "Oh, go milk old Bessie," I said. "She's got plenty more. Here, you can have mine." I pushed my glass over towards Larry's plate so hard that one almost spilled, too. "Y'all stop it right now," Mama snapped, and she seemed suddenly surprised at herself for losing patience with me already. For 6 weeks, she had fantasized about her little girl, building her up into a china doll in her mind. Now she was home, acting like she always did, a little girl. "Do you get spankings much?" Mama said. "I got one last night," I said. "What for?" "Jumping on the bed."
"And you got a spanking for that?" Daddy asked.
"Well, she spanked me because the bed slipped off that thing she called a frame and fell. And she said I was too fat to jump on the bed." Mama sank into her chair across from me. At that time, I only weighed 35 pounds. Was I getting spankings for things that were not important? Mama must have been wondering. Mama must have looked sick because Daddy quickly spoke up.
"I'll talk to Miss Johnson," he said.
"Can we show Susie the surprise now?" Larry asked.
"Oh, go ahead. You've probably told her already anyway, hasn't he, Punk?"
"You mean about the p—" Susie! Larry threw his hand over my mouth. I licked his fingers and giggled. He wiped them on my face, and we were just about to forget all about the piano until Daddy's big hand landed on one entire octave. I squealed as though I really hadn't known a thing. Daddy gathered two pillows to put on the chair and sat me down in front of the big wooden instrument.
It doesn't have any white things on some of the keys, Larry said.
Is it supposed to? I asked. I felt the flat, rough notes and began pushing them down one at a time. The F and G both played together no matter which one you pushed.
Look, I said to Larry, you can play chopsticks with one finger.
Then I found the familiar notes, and everyone was thrilled when I played Jesus Loves Me. I had been playing familiar songs on Mamaw's piano for almost 2 years. Now, for the first time, there was piano music in my own house. For some reason, I felt a pang of sadness. All I knew was that the piano was not there before, just like the rocks had not been there before. I began to cry without knowing why. At school, I was Myra, always thinking about familiar things from home. Now I was at home, and even those familiar things, like my own name, eluded me. The name, like the rocks and the piano, seemed all out of place.
"Don't you like it?" they all asked. "Do I have to go back?"
Chapter 5, Understanding. The strains of Jesus Loves Me played in Geneva's ears for days. What kind of Jesus let little girls be blind and their brothers cry for them, Geneva thought. Geneva, Lee said, I think you should get busy and do something. You've got to stop this.
Maybe you should think about getting a job. She's better off where she is, and you know it.
I don't know it, Geneva almost screamed at him. Don't you ever think about her screaming when we leave her there like that on the steps?
Doesn't it ever bother you?
Well, then, we'll just go get her, and she can grow up here in the country where nobody knows nothing about how to teach her. She can just grow up dumb.
I can teach her, I can, Larry cried.
Lee walked out of the room and slammed the screen door behind him, and Geneva knew the subject was closed forever.
Daddy was just teasing Larry, Geneva said as realization began to dawn.
She tried to comfort Larry, suddenly glad for the little child that she could touch, as I would be at school for a long time.
Chapter 6, Anne.
Myra, Miss Johnson said, this is Anne. She's a new girl. Can you show her around? I reached for the new girl's hand. It was sweaty, even in October.
Want a drink? I asked. I don't mean a real drink. It's just water.
Do you like it here? Anne wanted to know as we walked through the dark hall, which had become familiar to me.
We're going to have a Halloween party soon, I said. I'm going to dress up like a witch.
Is Mrs. Johnson mean?
No, she just talks that way, but don't let her catch you crying. She doesn't like it when we cry.
Do you cry?
Just sometimes in bed, but don't tell, I said as I put Anne's hand around the grooved knob and fastened it there beneath my own. I wished bedtime would come soon, but right now I was glad for the little warm hand I could touch.
Anne's little hand and mine grew into a friendship from that first touch. We began together learning how to survive and how to fit into the scheme of campus life at the ages of 6. Every 6 weeks we went to our individual homes, knowing we would look for each other the minute our mommies and daddies left us on those Sundays. Days and nights and Christmas and Easter came and went. Anne and I played in the big yard of Kay Cottage with all the other girls, and sometimes we all forgot about being homesick. Yet sometimes it seemed like an accompaniment played softly and sadly just behind our play. As time passed, Anne and I quickly moved into what Mrs. Johnson called the upper end room because we could button our dresses and tie our shoes. Hannah was in the third grade, but she was not able to tie her shoes, and she didn't want Mrs. Johnson to know it. So,
Every morning, either Anne or I would go somewhere with her and tie her shoes, and no one knew she couldn't do it herself. One Monday after lunch, Hannah came to the front porch with Hershey bars in her hands, 2 for Anne and 4 for me. "I love Hershey's," I said as I grabbed the Hershey's and kissed Hannah. "I know you do," she said. "Did you have a good weekend at home?" Anne asked Hannah. "I always have a good time when I go home," she said. "I got a permanent in my hair, too. Would you like to feel what pretty hair should feel like, Myra?" I stood up from the big green cane-bottomed chair and reached for her head. Hannah bent down for me to touch her hair. "Well, how do you like it?" she asked. There were tight little almost Shirley Temple curls everywhere, but I didn't care if her hair looked pretty or not. "It feels like little sausage rolls to me," I said. Hannah touched her tightly permed curls that stood apart in rows. Suddenly, it must have felt like little sausage rolls to her, too. "Well, at least I've got hair that looks like something," she said. I touched my own little stubs of curls that used to be long braids. They were beginning to grow back into misplaced little bunches of tiny waves. Tears filled my eyes. Somehow I knew that Hannah was the one who told Mrs. Johnson I cried when she combed my hair in the morning. Mrs. Johnson had cut the braids off still braided and gave them to the other girls to play with. I knew that's why I got more candy than Anne. "Thank you for the candy anyway," I said. Anne and I took hands and walked down the steps and sat on the large brick boulders beside them to eat one Hershey bar. "I wonder what we'll do this afternoon in school," Anne said. "I wonder if we're going to write with the slate and pointer again. Maybe we'll learn to write more words. Maybe we'll learn to spell permanent. Maybe we'll learn to spell mean," Anne said, and I handed her one of my candy bars. Chapter 7. Everyday Life in K Cottage. The house mother's name was Maud Johnson, and to me, her voice was as big as the building. She had a smoker's cough, and when she laughed, she would often find herself caught up in it. Sometimes it sounded as though she was fussing, but it was just her voice rolling along in that huffy rhythm. "Stand up or take them off," she screamed once, so I skated. While in kindergarten, I learned Braille, that there was actually a game to play called Mommy and Daddy, and that you can't sing and cry at the same time. All of us ate in the big dining room at little tables. I found that my bottom lip came just above the small table, and I found out that I could rake the food off my plate right into my mouth, wash it down quickly with the cold milk without ever tasting what I didn't like. I learned that sweet sandwiches were really peanut butter and jelly, and I didn't have peanut butter and jelly in Lexington that I knew about, and I loved them. There was a maid named Retha May who worked around the building cleaning bathrooms and our room. In the kitchen was another maid and a cook. Someone said the cook's name was Others. Every time we went to a meal, someone was called on to say a blessing before we sat down. I knew lots of blessings because Mama had taught them to me from the Sunday School Quarterly in Lexington. One of the blessings had a line in it that said, "Help me help others and be true to everyone, myself and you." "I dare you to say Retha May and Others in that blessing," a girl named Dorothy dared me. This sounded like a good idea to me, and I thought Mrs. Johnson would really like it. Finally, one morning, when Mrs. Johnson asked if anyone would like to say the blessing, I raised my hand. I don't remember the first lines of the prayer, but finally I got to the line. "Help me to help Retha May and others and be true to everyone, myself and you." "And I guess you thought that was cute." Mrs. Johnson's big voice boomed out the words to me. "No, ma'am, I mean it," I said. "First of all, our cook is named Others. Okay. Next, you can just go to your room and wait for the school bell." "I didn't think you would really do it," Dorothy told me after breakfast. "Here, I sneaked out a banana and a piece of toast for you. Now be sure you throw those banana peels in a trash can outside, or we both will get into trouble." I did walk outside, hide behind the bushes, and ate my toast and banana. I loved the outside yard and its sidewalks that snaked through the grass, leading to a road close to the other building. The campus at the State School for the Blind was a beautiful place. There were large oak trees with branches reaching across each other, making an umbrella on a rainy day. There were pine trees that supplied pine cones in the winter for making decorations for Christmas. There was a train track that ran around three sides of the campus that we learned we could count on hearing at certain times of the day or night. The large porch of Kay Cottage was a playhouse for all of us when we were not in the yard. We called the inn close to the small girls' ward the lower end porch. The other end was the upper end porch, and the middle, it was just a porch. There were not actually three porches, just one very long, very wide concrete walkway with a brick border about 3 feet high that ran all the way around, which was wide enough for us to sit on. There was a roof over all three divisions, as well as wooden benches and cane-bottom rockers that lined the walkways everywhere. The three divisions had steps going down to three walkways, approximately 15 feet each, that met in the middle at the campus post, turning into one walk that led through the spacious yard and ended up at the road about 20 feet away. The lower end porch was close to Y Cottage for the younger boys, and the upper end porch was just across from the ball field behind the gymnasium. Pullen Park was just across the school on the upper end side across Ash Avenue. We listened to the spring and fall to the music of the merry-go-round. Sometimes Mrs. Johnson took us over to ride the hobby horses and play on the swings. The merry-go-round not only had horses, but also had elephants and tigers, pink ponies and zebras. The inside animals went up and down as well as around. I had to be lifted by an official onto the red horses or the pink ponies, which were my favorites. The music played like an out-of-tune organ, and its songs burned themselves into our memories. It seemed like in the spring, music was everywhere.
You are listening to a presentation of the book Changing Places, written by and read by Myra Yarborough DeBruel. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is being produced in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. This ends Disc 1.